We're going to wait another couple of minutes.
Panelists will arrive. We live in the midst of the richest nation in the world. In spite of the fact that many of us feel we don't have enough money to meet our needs, the vast majority of us would fit into the upper 1% of the wealthiest people on earth. While many of us have problems or carry heavy burdens, they pale in significance with the suffering which characterizes a good deal of the developing world. Perhaps nowhere is the human tragedy more evident than in Africa, which seems to be a cauldron for the evils and misfortunes and disasters of the world. Today we address one of the most serious problems facing the people of Africa, the AIDS plague, which in general, the AIDS plague in general and its consequences in producing millions of orphans in particular, and beyond that, simply the devastation of all of those people who are both infected by it and who are affected by the consequences of it, even if they aren't infected. 30 million people in Africa are HIV positive. 3 million of these people die each year, and 3 million new infections are seen each year. And as mentioned in the description for this program, out of the 12 million AIDS orphans in the world, 95% of them are in Africa. Some of the questions which I hope we are able to address today is it possible to address a problem of this magnitude? That is, how does one go about even beginning to address a problem such as the one we're talking about? And if one does have the courage and faith to begin, what options and strategies are open to one, and what are currently being employed in Africa, and what can ordinary citizens do? So specifically, what can Latter-day Saints do to address this problem? I'd like to introduce our panel. Werner Wudufu is a person who has influenced my thinking a great deal, written a book called Working Towards Zion, Principles of the United Order in the Modern World. Is not here yet. I understand there's some traffic problems coming from the South. Cole Capener is the founder and trustee of Save African Families Enterprise, a relatively new initiative which Cole will tell us about, which is centered primarily in Zimbabwe, but expanding from there, Cole? Looking at South Africa now. Steve Mann, who is co-founder and board member of the Deseret Foundation, an AIDS prevention program, and who will speak to us about the experiences of his organization. The panel itself is what I'd hope to do, that we would begin with Werner, who would be telling us something about the sentiments which informed his book and some of the experiences that that have come out of it. Steve and Cole will talk about their personal experiences in setting up organizations which are designed to address this problem. We then will have a discussion among the panel members based on certain questions, and then hope eventually to throw this open to discussion of a general nature, whereby we will entertain questions from those of you who are here. We attempted to persuade the Sunstone Board that this should be the only panel scheduled at this time, but they were not open to that suggestion. So we will proceed and hope that those of you who are here can persuade other people to purchase tapes and get informed about what we're doing. One of the questions that that I asked that the panel could address has to do with the extent to which, as individuals, we might be complicit in what is happening in Africa. We find ourselves very distant from it. I teach in my literature courses a book called Heart of Darkness, in which Conrad writes ostensibly about Africa, but his book is an indictment of all of Europe that really created many of the conditions which led to the tragic consequences that he portrays in that. And I think Conrad, in that book, by extension, suggests that all of us have a heart of darkness there. And one of the questions that Susan Sontag, in her newest book called Regarding the Pain of Others, asks the question about our complicity, in which she says, so far as we feel sympathy, we feel we are not accomplices to what caused the suffering. Our sympathy proclaims our innocence as well as our impotence. To that extent, it can be, for all our good intentions, an impertinent, if not an inappropriate, response. To set aside the sympathy we extend to others beset by war and murderous policies, for reflection on how our privileges are located on the same map as their suffering, and may, in ways we might prefer not to imagine, be linked to their suffering, as the wealth of some may imply the destitution of others, is a task for which the painful, stirring images that we see in photographs of suffering in Africa and elsewhere supply an initial spark. To what extent are the consequences that we address today the problems that we ourselves should be involved with, at least in our imaginations, if not in our actions? And finally, to me, the question of how we are to be compassionate and what compassion really means. Susan Sontag says, compassion is an unstable emotion. It needs to be translated into action or it withers. The question is what to do with the feelings that have been aroused, the knowledge that has been communicated. If one feels that there is nothing, quote unquote, we can do, but who is that we? And nothing, quote unquote, they can do either, and who are they? Then one starts to get bored, cynical, and apathetic. I think this is demonstrated to me quite graphically when recently in a special article on Africa in the New York Times magazine, Sunday magazine section. As I was reading this article and as I was looking at these pictures of suffering and emaciated bodies, I turned the page and there was an ad for Gucci, and I turned another page and there was an ad for Range Rovers, and I turned another page and there was an ad for some kind of perfume or whatever, and the startling juxtaposition of these pictures showed how easily I could go from these feelings of empathy to the feelings of envy, and how does one hold these kinds of images in one's mind, if not in one's heart? I don't know about you, but as I read the scriptures, and I'm teaching the New Testament and Gospel Doctrine class this year, the hardest chapter in all of scriptures that I have that for me to get through is the 25th chapter of Matthew. Whenever I stop to ask myself, unto whom have I withheld, unto whom of the least of these have I withheld food and drink and compassion, and unto which of the least of these have I been willing to give it, I find myself challenged in ways that I'm not challenged, or to the depth that I'm not challenged elsewhere. So the 25th chapter of Matthew, who are the least? Certainly these African people, these dark-skinned, benighted people, must, in anyone who living in the developing world, must be considered at least among the least of these of whom Jesus speaks. So, since Warner is not here yet, let us begin with Cole talking about his experience in trying to, as an individual, trying to address this problem, and then we'll hear from Steve Mann. Hopefully by that time, Warner will have arrived.
Thanks, Bob. It's a pleasure to be here with you and with the panel today. This is Bob speaks of Warner being an inspiration to him. Well, Bob has been an inspiration to me, whether he knows it or not, in his thinking. I also read Warner's book, and it resonated with me, and has been, and that has been something that's been very important to me, the idea of succoring the needy. And another inspiration to me, and I'm glad that he's able to come, this is Steve Manns, who I'm a relatively latecomer to this this area, this arena, but Steve was there, is a real pioneer, and I'm sure you'll look forward to hearing his remarks. The numbers that Bob mentioned, the statistics, are almost mind-boggling. They are mind-boggling. They're stunning and staggering, and almost incapable of fully comprehending that this pandemic that HIV/AIDS has afflicted, and it is indeed devastating a continent. And it really knows no bounds. In Zimbabwe, where I've been active, and Steve also, the numbers are also equally overwhelming. 2,000 people die each week. Last week, 2,000 people died. This week, 2,000 people will die. Next week, 2,000 people will die. 170,000 pregnant women have HIV, 782,000 AIDS orphans, just in one country alone. In Zimbabwe, which has been a relatively rich country, and their life expectancy had been really growing upwards to 1980, the early 80s, and hit nearly 60. It is now, because of AIDS, under 45, 44. They've reached their zero growth rate, what they had initially as an objective, but that was originally intended as a means of controlling the growing birth rate. But they've reached the zero birth rate because AIDS have decimated the population. In South Africa, again, where we're looking, at 150 infants are born with HIV every day, 260,000 pregnant women with HIV. Just some of the statistics. Anyway, in the late 1990s, I started reading about AIDS in Africa, and I'm sure, like you, just astonished at what was going on. I started to think to myself, you know, I've always had a soft spot for Africa. I've always, as Bob alluded to, it seems like Africa has had a double dose or triple dose of challenges. And while my heart has been with China, I've spent most of my career in China. I just flew in from China last night or late yesterday afternoon, so you'll forgive me if my jet lag further fuzzes my mind. I can't usually use that as an excuse, though. But you know, it seems to me that Africa's always had the short end of the stick, and that I've always felt a need, a sympathy, but more than that, a religious conviction that we each of us have a responsibility. I'm certainly the scriptures that have always resonated with me besides Matthew 25 have been from the Book of Mormon, that we, as we join the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints, covenant to bear one another's burdens, to mourn with those that mourn, to succor the needy. And I think as you look, at least in my own scripture, in my search of the scriptures, I see that admonition repeated more often than any other. So if there's a pecking order of commandments evidenced by how often they're repeated, it seems like that our calling, our responsibility for those that stand in need is greatest in this area. Anyway, I wanted to do something as I read this, and I sat back, hey, what can I do? I'm a lawyer, number one. I mean, what can a lawyer do? Not much, right? I'm not a doctor. I'm not a nurse. I have no medical training. What can I do? What can one person do? And I think those are the questions that we frequently ask ourselves when confronted with an overwhelming kind of problem like this. And while I was thinking about those two questions, what can one person do? What can I do? I kept thinking about two quotes that have always had a powerful influence for me. One was by Margaret Mead, who said, "Never doubt that a small group of thoughtful, committed citizens can change the world. Indeed, it's the only thing that ever has." That has always rang true with me. The other was something Mother Teresa said. She said, "I don't do big things. I do little things with big love." And so I decided to take a leave of absence from my law firm and I started calling people. I called Steve. I called other people who put me in touch with other people who said, "You should talk to this person, that person." I was put in touch with a Stanford medical school professor, Dr. David Katzenstein, who was an early pioneer in Zimbabwe, who was pushing for treatment, bringing medicine to people with HIV/AIDS. There really are two. There's HIV/AIDS in Africa is a huge problem. It's multifaceted, but there are sort of two ways that are not mutually exclusive. But there are two camps that are going after. There's those that are pushing for prevention, education, prevent the spread of AIDS. There's another camp that believes that is trying to get medicine to help the people with AIDS right now. And Dr. Katzenstein, who I had started to work with, was trying to get medicine to HIV/AIDS patients. So I spent the summer in Harare, Zimbabwe, in 2001, working with Dr. Katzenstein and his group, and they were trying to lobby the government and try to set up a system whereby relatively inexpensive generic medicines known as antiretroviral drugs could be brought into Zimbabwe despite existing patents. And there were legal issues here. The patent holders of various antiretroviral drugs had received patents in Zimbabwe, and therefore the importation of generic antiretrovirals would offend those patents. But we started lobbying the government with the objective to try to persuade them to declare a public health emergency that would allow the importation of inexpensive generic antiretroviral drugs to begin treatment for those with HIV/AIDS in Zimbabwe. As many of you may know, there is no cure for AIDS, but there are medicines available, these antiretroviral drugs. You probably read about them, the so-called AIDS cocktail. drugs used in conjunction, usually AZT, 3TC, and some other drugs, used in conjunction can suspend the replication of the virus in the body and help prolong life. But they were expensive. Even at the generic rates, they are expensive. You've probably heard that drug makers have announced that price of a U.S. $1 per day, which is inexpensive compared to what Magic Johnson pays, probably $10,000 to $11,000 a year for his treatment, as an example, what it costs in the United States or Western Europe. But $1 a day, even for these generic drugs, is more than what most Zimbabweans make in a day. Nevertheless, we were trying to get the government to allow the generic drugs to come in, and I returned to the United States after my summer in Zimbabwe, and was pleased to learn that not long thereafter, the government actually did declare a public health emergency, providing a legal pathway for these drugs to come in. I went back and decided to set up a Utah nonprofit company called Saving African Families Enterprise. SAFE, SAFE is our acronym. It's homegrown. We have a couple of the board of trustees here, Bob Hughes and Bernice Clark. Our advisory committee, Bob Reese is on the advisory committee, Dr. Katzenstein, Dr. Dennis Israelski from Stanford is also on it. We set up SAFE in November. It received its 501c3 approval in December, and we started raising money and for the purpose of buying medicine to deliver to these, and we wanted to have a slightly different focus, and that is that there is a program where there is medicine available. What's our time anyway?
We were fine.
Okay. There is medicine available for a limited program in Africa and Zimbabwe. It's called the Mother-to-Child Transmission Program, the prevention of mother-to-child transmission. One of the major means of transmission, other through sexual intercourse, is from the mother to child at the time of birth. At the time of birth. While the baby is in the womb, it is protected by the placenta under normal means, and the mother does not transmit the virus to the baby during gestation, but at the time of delivery. Now, a single dose of medicine called nevirapine, or they also used AZT earlier, administered at the time of labor, delivery, one dose to the mother and a dose to the child, the baby, the newborn baby, is extremely effective at preventing the transmission of HIV from mother to newborn baby. Now, that's fantastic news, and that's spreading throughout Africa. There are a number of programs established in Zimbabwe. The patent holder of the drug nevirapine is a German company, Boehringer Ingelheim. To its credit, and we should laud this, they have agreed for 5 years to donate this medicine for 5 years for this limited purpose of mother-to-child prevention. It's fantastic. Now, the problem is, baby is born without HIV. Mother, of course, has HIV. Mother will die, and baby will be an orphan. The father has probably infected the mother and is dead before the mother. So, while we're saving the babies, they're still orphans after a few years. SAFE wanted to try and target families and to help the mothers and their husbands who have participated in this prevention of mother-to-child transmission programs. And that's what we're doing in Harare right now, actually in Chitumvisa, which is a high-density suburb of Harare. And the governments in Africa, the government in Zimbabwe, like the governments throughout Africa, many of them are, if they devoted their entire health budget to buying these antiretroviral drugs, they couldn't possibly treat everyone with HIV. So right now there's a limited context in which these medicines are being transmitted. Safe is working together with the University of Zimbabwe, Stanford University, with some money from the Doris Duke Foundation, and with the Médecins Sans Frontières, the Doctors Without Borders, in providing medicine for a research cohort. We're actually, and what you'll find in Zimbabwe and South Africa is that because the government can't give it to everyone, they start setting up the research cohorts with a limited number. And we're starting with a group of, actually, SAFE is providing medicine for the first 20 of these HIV mothers with a few of their husbands. And this group is going to grow to up to eventually 300. But the results of these kinds of studies, there's one, I just got the results of one from my friend with Doctors Without Borders in South Africa, are absolutely remarkable. They're treating in 300 HIV parents in Cape Town, South Africa, with the same triple therapy, these three this cocktail of AZT, 3TC, and nevirapine, and literally walking cadavers. I mean, men and women with CD4 counts, which is the cell that measures the development of AIDS. I mean, they're basically cells that fight disease. And once your CD4 count goes below 200, you're usually eligible for treatment. If you go below 50, you're in trouble. And a number of men and women with CD4 count below 50 have received treatment, and their CD4 count immediately goes up. I mean, they're actually adding years to the lives of these people who would otherwise pass away very quickly. Anyway, we are very excited about this program in Zimbabwe. I was there in June, and we actually negotiated with an Indian pharmaceutical company that provided the generic medicines, and while that was an adventure in and of itself, they actually did deliver the medicine in July, and the first patients started treatment at the end of July, I think it was. So we're very excited about that, and we're now negotiating for our second order of medicines to be shipped to Zimbabwe. At the same time, we're looking also in South Africa for a pediatric project, and there are a couple we've been talking with, one in Johannesburg and one in Cape Town, where they're focusing on treating children. Not every mother is able to participate in the prevention of mother-to-child transmission, so babies are born with AIDS. Not every mother who participates in that is lucky enough to give birth to an HIV negative child. But we have a small budget. We have no full-time or part-time salary staff. It's all basically volunteered. I do the legal work, and we're out raising money informally and formally. But it's something that's within the reach of everyone. I mean, basically, I've come to the conclusion that if I can do it, anybody can do it. And it's amazing what doors are opened if you only have the will and the desire to embark on that. Joseph Smith once taught that a person filled with the love of God is not content with blessing his family alone, but ranges through the whole world anxious to bless the whole human race. I think we as members of the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints have that challenge before us, that we have to seek out opportunities. And it seems to me there's no more compelling opportunity than the one that HIV/AIDS presents. Thank you.
Werner Woodruff wasn't here to hear all of the nice things that were said about him and his book, but we're delighted that he's here, and we'll turn some time over to him. If you are ready now, are you composed enough from the long, weary struggle up from Provo?
Sorry. Steve was called next. We have all these cute cell phones and stuff here, but I couldn't get through on any of them to tell them. Yeah, that's right. They're off. They should be off. One accident, four construction projects, three of which I didn't know about. The only good thing that happened since 10 o'clock when I left Provo, with an hour and 15 minutes, plenty of time to get here, was that when I was going 90 miles an hour after 21st South coming down to here, a cop passed me going 100 and didn't pull me over. So life is good. And this panel is not ended yet. Appreciate the chance to be here with you and learn from my colleagues and my friends about the work they're doing. And I was asked by Bob to talk just a minute or two about the context for Latter-day Saints responding to this crisis. And I assume you did your part. You talked about the problem, the severity and the challenges, and Susan Sontag and others perhaps. And has Steve spoken yet?
Not yet.
Okay, so I'm between you two. All right. Seems to me that this gospel we proclaim as Latter-day Saints has a lot to do with this problem of AIDS. And that there is a context in Mormonism for dealing with this horrendous Holocaust. I want to just share a couple of references. Ezra Taft Benson, quote, "The gospel is the perfect prescription for all human problems and ills." President Joseph F. Smith, on his uncle Joseph Smith himself. "The religion that doesn't have the power to save its people in this life will never have the power to save them in the next." That was the teachings of the prophet Joseph, he said. As we look at the social pathologies of today, hunger, suffering, AIDS, poverty, illness, the tragedies that are portrayed every day on the television, whether it's Afghanistan or Iraq or Liberia or whatever, I think we see through the gospel lens the responsibilities and the opportunities we have as Latter-day Saints to make an impact. John Taylor described these days, the last days, as very eventful days in which we have individual and collective duties to improve society and address the problems around us. Jeff Holland, Apostle Holland, "We're not yet the Zion the prophets foretold, but Christ has the answer to every social problem, political problem, economic problem." And he goes on to argue, "We can't maybe do everything, but we can each do something." David O. McKay, "What is it we seek in our lives? We seek, as Latter-day Saints, we seek a social utopia. We're not there yet." Hugh Nibley, "We shouldn't wait for permission to live the law of consecration. We ought to practice it in our personal initiatives." And he argues very eloquently the need for all kinds of service to our brothers and sisters. And the need for humanitarian efforts to help build that Zion through our personal acts of dedication and consecration. Yet today, as we look around the globe, we see Latter-day Saints in shanty towns. We see that about in 60 countries where we have significant numbers of Mormons, they're much worse off now than they were a decade ago. Life isn't getting better for many of them. They're joining the church. They're getting baptized. They're expecting a better life. They're having greater faith. But they're suffering. They're unemployed. They're jobless. They're diseased. Infant mortality rate for many is up. Illiteracy is significant. And we have members dying of AIDS around the globe. We have missionaries leaving their missions early. So I've been told by mission presidents in Africa to go home because they're dying of AIDS. So there's this challenge, I think, for both temporal and physical well-being that I read in the scriptures. And I love the words of President Hinckley, who gives a talk about humanitarian service about every 6 or 8 sermons he gives. And he talks about us reaching out, lifting the hands that hang down, strengthening the feeble needs, helping those who are unemployed, helping those who don't have access. And he also has made these interesting statements over the last few years. He says, one of my biggest worries is that we are over-institutionalizing our service to those in need. He's worried about this, the sense to which we as Latter-day Saints trust the institution. Let the church take care of it. Let welfare services take care of it. Let the government, let USAID, let the UN solve these problems. President Hinckley seems to make a plea for each of us to take individual initiative and action inconsistent with Section 58 of the Doctrine and Covenants, where we read that, we're agents unto ourselves, and there's much good we can do in and of ourselves. And then you've got quotes by people like President Harold B. Lee, who talks about the suffering saints in the third world, and says we might as well throw our hats in the air as expect to baptize them and have them enjoy a better life unless we first address their physical and temporal problems. It's not going to do much good. And so I've been struck as I began to think about preparing for this with the Savior's words in Matthew 25, where he talks about those who are hungry. This great parable on suffering. Those who are hungry, literally malnourished. The vulnerability that hunger brings to those who have AIDS in their earlier death rates and their suffering and their vulnerability to all kinds of disease, not just AIDS. Those in prison, I see AIDS as a kind of, not a physical prison, but an emotional and social prison in which we're putting them as outcasts. We're locking them up. They're cut off. They're rejected by society. Those who are thirsty for relief. Those who are naked. Those who are homeless. So many AIDS victims around the globe have nowhere to go. They only go home when they're buried. And the Savior's question to his people, as to why they didn't respond. And they said, when saw we thee? And he said, inasmuch as you have done it unto the least of these, my brethren, you have done it unto me. So I see this kind of sober reality of a multi-million person disease that doesn't get on our radar screens. When the Trade Towers went down and 3,000 people lost their lives, we were all horrified, and this country reacted with tremendous response of awareness, of sympathy, of love, of charity, of donating, of giving time, talents. A whole new consciousness developed for many Latter-day Saints and many Americans when that happened. What would it take if we looked at the fact that more people die from AIDS every day than that around this world, and that if you count children and malnourishment and the victims of poverty who die, We're talking 30 to 40,000 human beings every day of the year. And yet there doesn't seem to be that kind of sense of crisis or awareness or action. So I'm grateful for examples like that of Cole and his project in Africa and Steve Mann family taking up, moving up, literally packing up and moving to Zimbabwe and creating a foundation called Raising the Generation and working with Deseret International to try to address this. I'm impressed with my Peace Corps kids, BYU students. They've already served missions. Then they're finishing their bachelor's degree and they're coming to me and saying, hey, I want to do something with the next few years of my life before I settle down. What can I do? And they're joining in medical clinics in Africa. They're joining the Peace Corps in Ghana. They're working to address these tremendous problems. And I'm also impressed with the number of Latter-day Saints, not only in Utah or Idaho, but in the third world. I'm thinking of guys like Frederick Njinga, who created a foundation, a poor guy, handicapped, physically handicapped individual who's creating education programs and services for other handicapped people, including victims of AIDS. And student organizations like HEART launched out of BYU to go fight disease in Africa. These are kids. They're not rich kids. They're not impoverished kids. They're middle-class American kids who say, we can organize something. We can't do everything, as Elder Holland said, but we can do something. And they've gone off to do it. And they've had tremendous impacts and are being recognized by the UN as an impressive healthcare NGO, non-governmental organization, with no real budget, just goodwill and gospel values. President McKay, part of this context, the complete ideal of Mormonism is to make upright citizens in an ideal society. In other words, somehow we need to become the world's idealists, and we need to help build an ideal society, not the wretched problems we seem to suffer from today around the globe. And I'm thinking also of non-LDS humanitarians and advocates and visionaries like Mother Teresa with the Sisters of Charity, who says we must fight AIDS with our love. That's all it takes, she once said. Or Anne Frank, how wonderful it is that no one need wait a single moment to improve the world. We can each act. We can act now. So I would hope, as we embrace the principle of hard work, Wilford Woodruff said, we'll never establish Zion by sitting on a hemlock slab singing the songs of Zion. It requires real labor, real work, and I think that's how this problem of AIDS is going to be solved. And equality and other Zion concepts. Equality, in this case, with respect to AIDS, we're not talking income equality, but we are talking equality of opportunity, equality of access to medications, equality of opportunities for education, to build awareness, to prevent these kinds of problems. So let me just share, have I got another minute or two? Let me share my little list here of what would Jesus do if he were living among us as a Latter-day Saint today, looking at this problem of AIDS. One, this is just my list. This is my suggestions. I think you would encourage us all to make a donation on our church donation slips to combating AIDS. I think you'd have us write in where it says other, not just the Nauvoo Temple, not just helping missionaries with their funds, but creating a little, if enough of us wrote something in that blank space and put down $5 or $50 or $500 to combat AIDS, that could be of impact in the church, and it would help foster consciousness among the brethren in terms of what we might do and the importance of putting this higher on the agenda and making it eventually a real item on the donation sheet. What else? Another might be Item 2, suggestion 2, changing U.S. policy, suggesting to George W. Bush that $15 billion is too little, too late. We need to double it. We need to triple it. We need to make fighting AIDS as important as fighting terrorism. If we could get to that point, we'd have a lot more peace in this world and a lot less problems. We're caught up in the military-industrial machine. We need to have our government make the same kinds of priorities for the poor, for the sick, for the suffering, those who suffer from AIDS. I think in our teachings in the church, we also, another suggestion would be that we have greater emphasis in the church on warning us about AIDS. You know, I think we're still caught, when we talk about the word of wisdom, we're still caught in the paradigm of the past, of warning about smoking and drinking and coffee and so forth, and not enough about AIDS and the horrendous specter of AIDS that has flooded the world in the last two decades. What can we do in the church to change our seminary curriculum, our gospel doctrine classes, to put an emphasis on this kind of massive social problem? Another idea. What else might Jesus do? He might suggest to Bill and Linda Gates that they give a mere 2% of their wealth each year to fighting AIDS. That would be $1 billion a year of new money. And assuming they continue to grow in their massive accumulation of wealth, now that they've redesigned their $50 million house and got it to where they can, you know, where it's livable, perhaps they could give 2% a year. Okay, quickly. What else? LDS humanitarian organizations. Another step would be to have LDS humanitarian organizations begin to put an AIDS component into all the services they provide. We have some that just do literacy, some that do other kinds of medical care, some that do infant mortality, address infant mortality problems, some that do education, some that do square foot gardening, some that do microcredit, others that teach English, others do computer awareness and set up computer centers in third world villages, so that the poor and the indigenous in those societies can make the jump from the past century to the new world of high tech. What would happen if each of those LDS affiliated foundations, NGOs, etc., would have a little component and grow that component in terms of impacting through their humanitarian projects, impacting the AIDS problem? 10 years ago, there were 3 LDS affiliated foundations, as I've been able to determine. 3. 5 years ago, there were 100. Today, there's 200. A few more years, there'll be 1,000. And what would happen if each of those groups, those foundations, those groups of Latter-day Saints working on their own to solve global problems and provide humanitarian service, if they all had a HIV/AIDS piece of their outreach efforts? A couple other suggestions. Provo families living on the hills, threatened by wildfires. What would happen if those families moved down to more modest houses in the valley that weren't threatened by the wildfires of last night, with their one is a $13 million home, and if instead they were to plow that money into fighting AIDS? It might be interesting, and it might be safer for them as well. We could go to Africa like our colleagues here on this panel. We could dedicate some time each year within our own families and go out and try to do some good and address this problem of AIDS and come back changed from being a volunteer in Zimbabwe or wherever. Number 9, 1 minute to go. Number 9, I need a little water. This one is kind of personal, so I need to be lubricated for this. What would Jesus do? I think Jesus might tell the administration at BYU to to cancel its $60 million indoor football practice field. We've built this monstrosity. We're in the midst of building these two huge structures to strengthen our football team with $60 million. And they're making a big point. It's not church donations. It's not church money. It's private individuals, meaning Latter-day Saints, of their stewardship, giving the university $60 million so we can have a nice, big, warm building for our tough, macho, 300-pound big boys to practice indoors during December in the hopes that in some future date we might win a bowl game if we have more practice under safe, warm, comfortable working conditions. And they're doing that, they say, because that'll put BYU on the map. It'll result in people joining the church if we win a major bowl game. I would argue, this is just my little PR opinion, we'd be much more put on the map if we gave $60 million to an anti-AIDS fund and we sent 1,000 BYU students, including one or two football players, thank you, to Africa to combat AIDS. And if Mormonism became known as the religion that's putting its money where its mouth is about this horrendous problem and de-emphasizing football, and I'll even go as far to say basketball and volleyball and golf, which pretty much offends all of you, by becoming known for something very unique, and that would be a university with a humanitarian strategy and the funds to back it up. That's number nine. And last, number 10, I think Jesus might tell those of us at Sunstone to start our own anti-AIDS campaign and be less focused on intellectual topics and cute and fascinating points of church history, which we're still trying to understand, and move beyond the mental and theoretical to the practical and the realities of taking action, practicing our gospel, and fighting AIDS. Thanks very much.
Warner has been one of my mentors, and I think it's part because of his ability to offend more people in less time than anyone else I know.
Including you.
You know, the topic of AIDS is so huge, it's hard to know where to start. AIDS is a $100 billion business, with all the politics that can go into that, as you can well imagine. And if one gets hung up on the politics and the money, you just give up. But more than politics and money, AIDS is a disease that kills brothers and sisters and friends and neighbors and mothers and children and destroys society. I've really been asked to maybe do two things. One is to talk about my own experience in dealing with AIDS and how I got into that, and also to give maybe a little background to some of the things that the church is doing in Africa about AIDS. I got involved early on in two foundations. One of them is Deseret Foundation, and that Deseret does mostly easy-to-fix medical problems, cleft lips, cleft palates, crossed eyes, club feet, things that start with C. And they do that mostly in the Philippines, Central and South America. There's a few eye projects in Africa. We kind of used the Deseret banner to start our AIDS program in Zimbabwe because it was already organized as an NGO. And the background, I guess, just a little bit with Deseret was just one person, Bill Jackson, who said, I can do something, and went out and started doing it. The other foundation I've been affiliated with from the beginning is Enterprise Mentors. And Enterprise Mentors also started in the Philippines, focusing on kind of consulting around micro-businesses and then micro-lending. And part of Enterprise Mentors got involved in providing scholarships to return missionaries. And Enterprise Mentors, that part kind of became the model for the current church program, the Perpetual Education Fund. I think some of the things that we're starting have started to do in AIDS have become the model for the church's program in AIDS in Africa. And I say that because, you know, you always kind of, what, how do you get started and what's your relationship to the church? And probably 25 years ago, my father-in-law arranged a meeting with Neil Maxwell, and I was kind of sharing some of my thoughts and hopes and dreams, I guess, in the humanitarian area. And Elder Maxwell said, "Steve, whatever you do, don't do it through the church. We'll kill you. We'll smother you. Go out and do something." And that's probably one of the best pieces of advice I ever got. And so I've always tried to do that and affiliate myself with organizations who go out and do things on their own. And interestingly enough, nearly all of them have ended up coming back and sponsoring or working with the church to sponsor church programs. So I guess there's various ways to get to where you want to go. I started getting involved in Africa probably 25 years ago on business. And then with Deseret, we had some eye programs over there, and all the rest of the board were return mission presidents from South America or somewhere like that. Nobody ever deals with Africa, so I started kind of looking after the African issues with Deseret. And about 6 years ago now, I guess I was there and saw the eye program that we had, cataract program, growing, developing, doing well, but AIDS was wiping out everything we were doing. So I came home, and about a year later, I was at the annual high priest meeting with wives, and the subject was the need for a couple missionaries. And I have six, or had at that point, six dependent children. So about halfway through, I turned to my wife and said, "Look, we can't do that, but who needs a calling? Want to go to Africa and see if we can make a difference with AIDS?" She said yes. And a year later, we were living in Harare with six children, trying to say, "Now what? We're here. What do we do?" Well, I approached it as a business. My background is business, and I started going around the country to every meeting I could find, every discussion group I could find, trying to see what was going on. We had an original idea that was try to find a way to help children who had been orphaned due to AIDS. Well, the more I went around, the more I became convinced that the best way to help orphans was quit making new orphans, and that meant prevention. And you would think in a country where 25% of the adults are HIV positive, and the average life expectancy for HIV positive people there is about 6 years, there would be huge programs going on in the area of prevention. But there were not. There were condom ads everywhere, and a big backlash about condoms, and there was little else going on. So we started developing approaches to look at behavior change. Now, behavior change is everybody's last choice in trying to deal with anything because it is so blasted difficult. But with AIDS, we're not left with many options. There is no vaccine. No one has a clue when one will be available. The treatments are expensive, and in Zimbabwe, at least, the healthcare system has basically collapsed over the last 3 years. And so that leaves us with trying to change behavior. Fortunately, there's some good models. In Uganda, which used to have the world's highest AIDS rate, the infection rate has dropped from probably somewhere in the 28-30% down to probably about 6% over the last 10 years. And the primary reasons are the average age of first sexual encounter is 2 years later than it was 10 years ago. Far fewer sexual partners, and some increase in the urban areas in the use of condoms. But what it says is you can change behavior. So when I look at AIDS, it is not rocket science. I think we know what to do. And we basically know how to do it. The problem is the political will and the focus to make things happen. And in Africa, that's very, very different because things get so politicized so quickly. And so many other priorities, like staying in power, come ahead of trying to take care of people. Anyway, we started creating these programs, and it was one of the great things about doing this is it turned out to be a very, very ecumenical program. I happened, when I'd been there about 3 weeks, to run across a Catholic sister from Uganda. She's an OBGYN, spent 10 years, 20 years in Uganda under Idi Amin and all the worst regimes in the world. Pretty tough lady. And she was there with this program. I saw it. I liked it. I said, look, can you come back? Well, she came back. And we had invited people from government, from education, from the military to come see this program. And just before she starts, I'm thinking, what am I doing? I don't even know what this thing is. I got all these people here. Well, it turned out to be a program really focused on behavior change. So we took their program with their permission and took out all the Catholic stuff and put in stuff that led more toward taking action. We're now teaching hundreds of thousands of Catholics in their own program, kind of redone. But one of the great joys over there is everybody puts, not everybody, but most people put their 2% religious differences aside, concentrate on the 98% we all share, and go to work on AIDS. In fact, my motivation for going over there was on one trip to Zimbabwe. I sat down with Sister Noreen, who was a Catholic sister who had started an AIDS an AIDS care program, a hospice program in Harare. And she said, "Steve, I failed." I said, "What do you mean you failed? Look at all the good work you're doing. Right now they're taking care of about 2,000 AIDS orphans just in the Harare area." I said, "How can you say you failed?" She said, "No." She said, "We have failed. I thought with some education we would turn this thing around. Instead, it's just getting worse." She said, "Somehow we've got to start teaching morality." Well, interestingly enough, that's essentially what we're doing now, is teaching morality. We just don't call it that. In fact, our program that started just with nothing now has support from UNAIDS, from the National AIDS Council, from USAID, and it's really teaching morality. And they're buying into this. So the biggest thing we probably did was try to create a model for looking at behavior change that can work. Now, I should say that a lot of what we do is teaching, but teaching doesn't change behavior. It's a first part of it. We try to focus on a 14-year-old. A 14-year-old, the first thing they need is accurate information. And you would think with everything going on that would be there. But I talked to a group of young single adults in Soweto about 2 years ago. There's AIDS stuff all over South Africa. And I was listening, there was another person talking. I was listening and seeing their reaction. I could see them kind of glazing over. So I went down the audience and said, "All right, how many of you, young single adults, very well educated, how many of you think AIDS comes from mosquitoes?" Half the hands went up. And then their questions went to, how close can I get? How much sex can I have without getting in trouble with AIDS? So they were clearly looking at it that way, not how do you stay away from things. Well, I guess a couple of things that I'd like to say from my own experience is, one, you can make a difference. You know, with all these huge organizations, billion-dollar organizations, some of them, you say, well, how can I fight this battle? Well, you can. You can create models. We can use our own LDS values and use those to create models. And as some of my old professors used to say, there's nothing as good as a good model. And if you can create a good model, the world is waiting for that. The second thing, let me just talk about quickly, is sometimes the question gets asked, is the church doing anything about AIDS in Africa? I had been there about 6 months, and I was out giving a talk downtown for the Ministry of Health on, and my background is not medicine, but I was giving a talk on tuberculosis. My driver comes against me and says, "You got to come right now." Okay. So I kind of finish my talk, go out, and he says, "Call this number." So I call the number, and I get the mission president's wife, Sister Edwards. She says, "Hold on to your caller. Hold on for your caller." Well, my caller comes on the phone and says, "Steve, how are you? This is Elder Ballard. I'd like to talk to you. Can you come up?" "No, sir, I'm busy." So I said, "You bet. I'll be right up." Well, Elder Ballard, I knew because he had married me 20 years ago. And my wife was one of his missionaries. I knew he was going to be in Africa. That's all I knew. He spent the rest of the afternoon with the area presidency wanting to learn about AIDS. wanting to understand it, what's going on. About 6 months later, I get a call from the area office, and they said, look, Elder Holland is coming over, and he's first contact over Africa, and he wants to meet with you, and he wants you to bring a doctor. It's like, what kind of a doctor? What do you know? Well, we got, actually, the doctor we got was the WHO leader over Africa. And Elder Holland came with no other reason. He had no other kind of appointments there except we spent the day talking about AIDS. He wanted to know what was happening, what the issues are, what the approaches were. Part as a result of that, when some extremely interested and dedicated people in the area office in South Africa, the church decided to put together an AIDS program. And the program, and I've never seen the church do anything like this. It's a four-week program. The first Sunday, they take 2 hours out of the block, so everything but sacrament meeting. And it's an open, free-for-all discussion in various age group about AIDS and where it comes from and how it's contracted and what it does to the body and what the options are. And we teach facilitators how to do this. The second Sunday, it takes a Sunday school hour, and the topic is free agency and chastity. The third Sunday is AIDS in the family, and the fourth Sunday is AIDS in service. I've never seen the church take time out of the block to do something like this. We have now trained people all through English-speaking East African area, and the translations should be done this week so they can take it to the French-speaking, the DRC, the Congo, and Portuguese-speaking in Mozambique. And in a course of 1 year, the church will have taken nearly everybody through this program. Now, the interesting thing about this is most of the programs people run in education, you get 5% of the people attend because it's run on Saturdays or weekdays. And almost all of those are women because men don't come to stuff like that. With the church's program, you have 100%. And so they're also now making a generic Christian version of this. We take out the Book of Mormon scriptures, we take out the references to general authorities, and we put in different church leaders from various churches around Africa. And we're on the World Council of Churches AIDS board, and they're very interested in trying to make this available to their people. So the church is doing some things, and again, trying to set some models, and they're doing those things with other religions, trying to find a way to deal with HIV. And I think I'm out of time, and it's time for our panel.
I don't know about you, but I find myself inspired by three Latter-day Saints who have taken the Lord's admonition to not be commanded in all things, but to do many things of their own free will and choice. Let's give them all another. One of the things that occurs to me is that the choice we have is addressing the problem now or addressing it later with much more tragic and much more serious consequences. These 12 million AIDS orphans, if we don't do something to help them, will grow up to become parents, to become HIV positive, and to produce more AIDS orphans. It is hard for us to get our minds and our imaginations and our hearts around a problem of this dimension. Consider 12 million children without parents, 12 million mothers who aren't there to wipe away tears, or to sing songs or to tell stories. 12 million fathers who aren't there to teach and to touch, to protect and to provide. And how many millions of people who are called in to become surrogate mothers and fathers, which is what the scriptures suggest we all become. That is, it seems to me that one of the things the gospel of Jesus Christ should provide us with is the ability to imagine not only the dimensions of this problem, but to imagine solutions. Warner talked about some of the things that Jesus might do if he were here. He suggested that one of the things is that if we could get the Gates to contribute 2% of their income. I have another idea that Cole knows about. It's called the 1% Solution. And it grows out of a course I teach at the university called Modern Moral Problems. And in that course, we talk about a number of contemporary ethical and moral issues. And I use an example of a philosopher from Princeton who presents this little case. You have all of your money invested in a classic Bugatti car. You're driving it to get insurance, and it stalls on the railroad track. You get out to walk to get some help, and you notice that there's a switch there, and you notice a train is coming. And you can switch the train so it doesn't come and hit your Bugatti. But you notice that on that other track a child is playing. And if you switch the train to miss your Bugatti, it will hit and kill a child. So the question that the philosopher proposes is, what would you do? Well, I haven't met anyone who would save the Bugatti. But then he makes it a little more uncomfortable for us. He says, according to the United Nations, $200 will save the life of a child someplace in the world this year. It's not your classic Bugatti that is now at stake, but it's $200. And how many of you hearing this story would be willing to give up another pair of shoes that you probably don't need, or to stay away from another expensive restaurant meal, or to give up a few movies? All just $200 this year. And when I ask this of my students, it's interesting to watch them squirm. My idea of the 1% solution is that there's probably no one living in North America, or certainly very few, who could not afford to give 1% of their annual income or their annual increase to address some of these problems. So I would suggest, I hope at some point, to have some mechanism for allowing people or encouraging or enabling people to do this, but you don't need a mechanism. You can give 1% to either one of these organizations. You can give 1% on your tithing envelope. And I suspect, since I'm speaking at Sunstone, even though when I was chairman of the board of Sunstone a couple of years ago, we did a survey and we found out that the Sunstone subscribers and attendees have a higher percentage of sacrament meeting attendance, temple attendance, and tithing payment than the church average. But if I am speaking to anyone who for any reason no longer pays their tithing and doesn't feel inclined to do so, I would encourage you to go back to paying tithing, but to pay it, if you don't feel comfortable paying it in the normal way, to pay it to one of these organizations or to some organization which is addressing these human problems. 1% is not very much. It's only half of what we're going to ask the Gates for.
Bob, okay. I'd just like to point out that Bill Gates is putting tens of billions into AIDS in Africa, so he's doing his part. Yeah. So it's just us now.
Just us. Oh, just us.
And Annie Dillard, in one of her books, says, the Lord says, who will I send? Who hath clean hands and a pure heart? And Annie Dillard says, who will the Lord send? He's never had anyone but us. We are the ones. We have a few minutes for some questions. If anyone has questions to... Yes, back here. Yes, brother in the orange shirt.
First, thank you for the most meaningful session I've ever been to at Sunstone.
Oh, thank you.
And two, to warn her that you have 10 suggestions.
Yeah.
I don't mean this in a jocular way, but how did they get that through... correlation.
Yeah.
Okay.
I'm quite serious.
The question is, how can one begin to put into effect the top ten, Orner's top ten? And you should come here and address this so that it's recorded. Is that your question?
That's it. And also the 1% solution.
Yeah. Well, so let me just say, it sounds crazy, but it's very doable and it's very simple. Now some of those 10 aren't church stuff, right? Some of those we got to do on our own and in our own way, and we got to lobby the board of Sunstone and others to do their piece of it. But in terms of the church, think it's real simple. We just do what we did in the mid-80s. When you remember the crisis in Ethiopia? And we were watching babies die on TV in colored television sets across this country. What did that do? We watched it for 6 months, and we were watching it for a year. Then a lot of Latter-day Saints started doing the following. They started writing letters to Salt Lake. They started asking for the church to get involved. They started wondering and raising questions about why we don't do something. And then they started to get these kinds of letters that would say, I'm Brother so-and-so from wherever. And I'm going in at the end of the year to declare myself a full tithe payer, but I'm giving 5% of my 10% to Catholic Social Relief Services. I'm giving 2% of my tithing to the Mennonite Foundation to fight the starvation in Ethiopia. And when those letters started arriving, and others who had been less active or inactive in the church for years, saying, if the church starts something, I'll start giving money back to the church. I'll start again giving money to the church. It had a huge response. First debate, first confusion, first denial, first letters, first calls, I guess they didn't have emails then. But I've heard a lot of those folks up there talk about how that impacted them. And they began to say, what's this Ethiopia deal? What's going on? So forth. The upshot of that was they gave some money to Catholic Relief Services. Then they gave some money to the Mennonites. Then they said, let's organize a fast and have a one-day fast. It took 6 months of debate for them to agree to do that. Because many said, if we do that, they'll cut back on their fast offerings. But let's have a special fast for Africa, one day only. And it brought in, what was it? $9 million. And the next month and the next month, fast offerings were higher than ever. And they began to say, it's not an either or. It's not a, you know, we take it from here, we give it there, we lose it here, whatever. And that led to the creation of the Humanitarian Services Fund. And that, after a lot of years of experimentation, moved them to create Latter-day Saint Charities. And I could see the church 5 years from now, whatever, depends on us, imploring them, donating them, writing AIDS, combating AIDS, alleviating AIDS on that donation. I see the church 5 years from now announce a new perpetual AIDS fund to solve the problems of AIDS in Africa. You say, well, it can't happen. I say, they're brethren. They listen. We pray, we donate, they'll respond. They're very responsive.
Thank you, Werner. Keep in mind that the welfare program started in a ward in a stake here in Salt Lake, and it is now a worldwide program of great dimensions. This sister here. We would love for you to.
Thank you, gentlemen, for an incredible experience to hear you. Let me just tell you one instance of where a person made a difference, like you said. My sister and her husband served a mission in South Africa 4 or 5 years ago, Kay and Bob Weber. They noticed that there were no educational experiences for young black women. The young men could, some of them, go to school, but black women couldn't. So they started an education fund there are 9 girls in our family. It's called the Brock Bank Education Fund. The first year, we had 10 black women in college. There are 3 requisitions. They must be black, they must belong to the LDS Church, and they must live in M.Dot Sani Township. The first year, we had 10 black women in college. The next year, we had 15. This year, we have 31 black women in college. We're getting our first graduates. One black woman graduated first in her class from the university and is now in medical school in Durban, learning to be a doctor. She may make a difference with the AIDS program. This has been an incredibly successful program, and it just started out with 1 or 2 people. So we can all make a difference.
Great. One other thing that you might do is what I do every year in my high priest group. I give them a list of 2 or 3 projects that they can contribute to. Last year it included SAFE, it included one of the former members when I was bishop, one of my Relief Society presidents has gone to Kosovo to start a program to teach music to children. and the other was a program to help some of the poorer saints in Lithuania. For the past 3 or 4 years, members of my high priest group have contributed any place between $600 or $700 and $1,000, and they can choose where it goes, and that's a pretty easy thing to do. So that can be also multiplied. The other thing Werner's inspired me. I'm going to suggest to the Sunstone Board of Trustees that we start a Sunstone AIDS project, to get a mechanism for people to contribute to that. There was a question here. Yes, this brother, please come up and.
Could I just ask while you're coming up, if we want to make a donation to the Brock Bank Foundation, how do we do that?
Brock Bank Education Fund.
Okay.
And
where?
You
got a website or anything? We'll talk. Okay. All of us want to find that out, so I'm just saying.
Yes, this brother.
Couple questions. One is, I guess one thing that I've been trying to figure out is, what is the best way to evaluate the best way to give money? I mean, I've consciously, I live in California. I don't have a car. I've been consciously saving up. But I discover I just don't have enough time to evaluate all the options. What's the best way to go about figuring out how to donate? And I guess the second one is, we talked a little bit about, how to try to get grassroots movement to get the church to do things, and I'm comfortable with the idea that the church should focus most of its efforts on church organization and just getting the buildings and stuff like that. But how can we contribute to a better atmosphere in church members to donate, so that church members donate another 10% of their money to things like that? How can we foster that sort of atmosphere? I'm fine with the church not devoting too much efforts to this, but how can we get the people in the church? How can we foster this atmosphere that I think most of the people who decide to come to this have?
Cole?
So those are two.
I'm going to speak to
the first question, and that is, how do we evaluate to whom we give? And maybe I can ask or suggest another answer. Some people may not be able to give much of their money and may be able to give more of their time. And time is money, obviously, and some can also give their time. In fact, some organizations are better able to accept volunteers of time than others. I know Steve and I have talked about this in the past about sometimes it's difficult for organizations to absorb volunteers, whereas other organizations, actually need them. So, one, it's a matter of some investigation. As to which organization should you give your money, I think that turns on a couple of things. One, first, I think you should find, within the AIDS community, there are different focuses, as I suggested. I think there are those, like Steve's organizations, that focus on prevention. And that's very, very critical, very important. You want to reduce the rate of new infections by prevention. There are others, like my organization, SAFE, that focus on treatment. We want to keep the people that have AIDS right now alive so they can raise their children. We want to keep children who have AIDS alive so they can have healthy lives. That's a different approach, but it's also very important. I'm not saying which is more important. I think they're equally important, but one might resonate more with you. There's also a sort of third dimension, caring for AIDS orphans, which is a separate but also critically important component in this whole AIDS campaign. I think you need to think which one resonates more with your own personal interests and give to them. I don't think when you look for an organization, there's always also, you need to look for efficiency. How much of the money that you give will actually get to the intended beneficiaries? And that, we've had in the United States some of these horror stories of United Way paying these horrible, outrageous salaries. And what you can actually get in a lot of organizations will let you know how much of their proceeds are used for overhead, how much are used for fundraising. The Salvation Army, for example, has always sort of been the standard. They've always set a standard, I think, of 85% of their proceeds that they received actually go to programs. And so 15% goes to overhead and fundraising costs. Now that's a very small amount, because it does, to run organizations, it does, you, especially some of larger, it does cost something. You know, you, if you have employees, fundraising does cost money. So, but that's what I would look at, the efficiency, how much is actually getting to the intended beneficiaries. Say, for example, it's virtually 100% because we have very little overhead. But the second question I'll let one of the others respond.
Another answer to question, if you want to know what cause you can give to, one of the wonderful things about Warner's book is that it's got a list of a number of the humanitarian service organizations that that contribute. We have, I think we're supposed to be through by now. Is there another group coming in here? Oh, it's lunch, so we can take a few minutes. What was the second part of the question?
How to get LDS members to give?
Yeah, Warner, would you take
it?
Do
you want to?
Let me just say a couple things.
First, just a word on that first question. There are lots of horror stories on how things get used badly, and huge organizations like the UN take huge organizations, but you also have enormous amount of money that goes into salaries and everything else. I would find, if I were starting, somebody like Cole or something like Deseret, where everything is volunteer and the money's going to get there. And then you can find out periodically what you're doing. But what that means, if you find somebody who's doing something, who's established in some country, but they're built on values that you believe in, they're doing things you believe in, 80 or 90% is going to get used for the people instead of the 20%, which often happens with some of the larger ones. In terms of how you get LDS people more involved in doing things, I think really the example that Bob gave is probably